Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are. This is Powering Bitcoin. I am here today with Nathaniel Harman. Hello.
How's it?
How's it? Nate, that's okay. We talked before. Before we get started, I'm going to do, as usual, a bit of housekeeping. Nate, can you give me the current block time, please?
The current block height is 775,330.
There's two types of people in this world, Nate. Some that read out the block height like you, and the others that read it out 775,330. It's interesting. Everybody, I'm always sort of anticipating who reads it out which way. 775,000. There you go. The last difficulty change was plus 4.68%. Miners keep connecting, keep trucking. Price went up a bit. And lots of machines still sitting in warehouses, collecting dust, looking for cheap energy sources. The current hash rate is 290 exahash per second, and the current hash price sits at $75 per petahash per day. So that's a nice little increase from the bottom there that we had around 6, even I think 58, 60. I want to highlight a quick article. A quick article is pretty lengthy. But let me quickly highlight it. It's called Gorillas, Militias, and Bitcoin, Why Congo's Most Famous National Park is Betting Big on Crypto. Minus the crypto piece, that's a great-ass title, I think. Made me want to read it right then and there. It reads like a book. It's basically on the Virunga National Park and the mining that's happening there in Congo. Definitely worth a read. I'll put it in the show notes and, yeah, have a look at that. But let's get to the main business. Nate, give us a bit of background for those who have not listened to your voice. Aloha, first of all. Let's get it started.
Aloha, and thanks for having me on, Jesse. This is an awesome podcast, and we're about as far as two people can possibly be from each other, and you know, we're connecting over the power of the internet. It's amazing. I've been to South Africa. It's a beautiful country, and I hope to get back one day. So I guess my background in Bitcoin. Do you want the real one or the one that we tell? the one that we tell.
The one that you want to tell, Nate. Oh, there will be no judgment.
Well, it started trying to buy weed on the internet. That was where it all began, and trying to figure out how to do that. I ended up getting my real journey started in, I guess, graduate school, when I realized that I had all these extra, all this extra electricity in my office that I never used. I'm a analytical chemist. I come from a marine geochemistry background. And, I was working in a lab all the time. And I had an office, just never using it. Electricity, it was constantly cooled. And I had, known about Bitcoin for some time. But figured, well, hey, nobody's gonna see, there's all these sub-zero freezers in the building. There's an ICPMS. Nobody's gonna notice a handful of ASICs in my office whirling. And so I started setting them up, and eventually we expanded to, from my office to friends of mine offices as well. And that's really where the story of my Bitcoin journey, starts.
Nice. What's an ICPMS?
Inductively coupled plasma mass spectrometer. It's used for measuring isotopes in different samples. Okay. You can use isotopes to track certain processes. It's how we You know, it's how we it's the fingerprint of humanity and the carbon dioxide record in the atmosphere. You know, everyone talks about, oh, it's just the carbon dioxide. Well, where does the carbon dioxide come from? How do you know it's not just rocks? And the answer is because isotopes. There's heavier versions of carbon. There's carbon 13. There's the lighter version, carbon 12. And you know, rocks don't care, right? Rocks are dumb. They're dumb, right? Rock processes don't differentiate, but if you're a plant and you're incorporating carbon into your cellular structure, well, a carbon that weighs 12 versus a carbon that weighs 13, it's like walking around with a heavier backpack all day. You want to walk around with as light of a backpack as possible, so they preferentially choose carbon 12 over carbon 13. So when we measure carbon in the atmosphere, sorry, yeah, let's go into science lessons.
we just might do a sideshow here and get you back for chemistry lesson.
That's my background. I'm an environmental scientist.
I already have a bunch of questions for you. So basically says you had a lot of stuff in your office or in your building that used a ton of electricity, and hiding a Bitcoin miner wasn't really going to make anybody frown. Are those miners still there?
No.
Okay.
No. I'm not still there, so they aren't as well.
And through that faculty or through that education, is that also where you, because I remember hearing you on Troy Cross's podcast, the first episode where you talked about Mora et al. And the paper and Bitcoin's energy use and all of that. And that's a big topic of mine. Is that also where you sort of, got linked to that whole story?
Yeah. I was hosting this Friday Powhana for the entire SOAS department, School of SOAS Science. SOAS is the School of Ocean, Earth, Science, and Technology. And at the University of Hawaii, Manoa, we have a Powhana on Friday evenings called TGs. And I was the host of it for some time. And as anyone who's going down the Bitcoin rabbit hole, it's pretty much all you talk about. And so I was talking to anyone and everyone at TGs about Bitcoin, including a few of the authors of that paper, the TAs. They were, now they have PhDs and they're doctors, but at the time they were graduate students, like me, and we were talking about Bitcoin, and the subject of energy use came up, and the idea that you can monetize curtailed energy sort of lit a fire under them. So they took, I planted this seed, and they took it to their and proposed it to this undergraduate class that they were teaching under, the professor, Dr. Camilo Mora. And that was the inspiration for that paper. I guess I didn't do a good enough job communicating the end message of, no, it's a very useful energy, technology. It's not. And then, of course, the paper was written by undergraduates. It was not Camilo Mora, The analysis was generally correct. The math was correct. It's just the network that they were describing, even though they used the word Bitcoin, was not the network they were describing was not Bitcoin. So I kind of, that was the
100%. I mean, it makes me frustrated, right? Seeing this even so many years later, used again and again in citations, where just like this is it's so effortless. Like there's no effort behind your argumentation. Like if that's your source, right? There's no research done. So for someone who was there when it was created, this monster, it must drive you nuts to see that still cited everywhere in research papers by big institutions.
it was never meant to be cited, and that's the, you know, it's, you can't blame the undergrads who wrote it, you can't blame the, you know, the TAs who, you know, floated the idea, who I, you know, still have connections to. You know, Katie Talladay is a wonderful person, great scientist. Randy Rollins is a friend. But, you know, it's those institutions for not reading the paper and just blindly quoting things. You know, it's misinformation, and it happens not just, you know, for them. It happens all over the place. It's really their fault for quoting a bad, misquoting a paper.
You know what? I spoke to Colin Sullivan recently when we recorded as well, and his input was that Bitcoin's energy use is so... I would like to have your quick take on that before we get into your company and the madness behind OTEC. He was saying that because it's so transparent, like Bitcoin's energy use is so transparent and easy to understand, that is why it's so attacked and so often used as a negative, right? Because he was saying there's no way to measure the energy consumption of the fiat system. But it's very transparent to see what happens on the Bitcoin blockchain, right? What the hash rate is, I just read it out. And so therefore he's saying that's the reason why it's always so singled out, the energy use. Do you agree, or do you have a different idea?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You know, we've never had a way of, I mean, I've done a lot of research into, you know, global energy use, and the records are generally pretty shit. They're not self-consistent, and they're, you know, off by order of magnitude. With Bitcoin, you're really refining that estimate because it is so transparent. It's a, you know, it's a record of energy use. It's an immutable record of energy use that you can use to extrapolate other qualities of Bitcoin. And, you know, if Bitcoin is to become the world reserve currency, which I personally believe, then Bitcoin becomes a decent proxy for global energy use, providing an unmatched record. I think that's pretty accurate.
Nathan, as a scientist, many in your field are also scientists, and there are many different sources. We just talked about the transparency of the Bitcoin network, right? You can go to the Bitcoin Mining Council, you can talk about the Cambridge source and the Alex de Vries source, which is also still out there. As a scientist yourself, what energy or what resource do you use to when it comes to quoting Bitcoin's energy use, and why?
So for Bitcoin, I use the sources you mentioned, but for global power plant, you know, for global energy, you know, production, I use the World Resources Institute Global Power Plant Database through access through ArcGIS. You know, it makes it pretty easy. I can, you know, define certain latitude, longitude, distance from coast, access to deep water, and then narrow, you know, how many power plants potentially we could replace one day. But from, I mean, I have our, we developed our own model that converts hash rate to a price per kilowatt hour, and you can back using that same database, using the, you know, sort of average terahash per second, you can extrapolate the global price per kilowatt hour that the Bitcoin network pays on average, and then from there you can back out the global energy use.
Do you know what the current values are?
No, I think it's out of date. I think the last time I updated it with up-to-date information was about a quarter ago or so. I think it's time to go back in and finish out the year.
Would you say it's higher or lower than 6 cents USD per kilowatt hour that Bitcoin miners use?
So I think the average for the year, because the way that I'm looking at it, from building a power plant specifically to mine Bitcoin, I look at sort of an average. So the day-to-day, you know, the average for last year was around 16 cents. You know, it started much higher in the year, and then it ended lower. So when you take the average of the year, it ends up being higher. But yeah, currently it's 6-7 cents per kilowatt hour. And of course, that's going to depend on, you know, the efficiency that you're running at, what machines you're running at.
Absolutely.
But the average.
I mean, with a hash price of 75 USD per petahash per day, you know, there's not much room for overheads if you pay 7 cents on average, right? So only the big miners would be able to survive long term, who have, you know, economies of scale and low overheads compared to the hash rate that they produce. But yeah, you already alluded to it, Nate. Let's maybe get into OceanBit a bit. Give me a bit of background on the company history. Where did it start? Did it start in a garage? Who's working with you? What are you guys focused on?
Sure. Well, it started in graduate school. Like I said, I was mining Bitcoin in my graduate office. And as a marine geochemist, I was made familiar with ocean thermal energy conversion, partly because the University of Hawaii is the preeminent institution in the U.S. for studying ocean thermal energy conversion. And that's because, of course, Hawaii is one of the only states in the U.S. that can take advantage of it. And so, you know, I had mining Bitcoin, talking with Camilo Mora, you know, talking with these, you know, his TAs. And I started, you know, looking into how does the state actually make a transition to renewable energy. By 2045, we have a law mandate. Of course, you can change. They will change that if we don't end up making it to that. But how do we actually do it? And so I did this analysis. You know, solar. Well, Hawaii doesn't have land for solar. Wind. You would need an offshore wind farm 4 times the size of Oahu, or, you know, the main island in Hawaii. And then of course the batteries and, you know, geothermal. Yeah, we have volcanoes, but they're not in the right place. They're on the Big Island of Hawaii, and that's great for the Big Island. They can use that. There's a little bit of political controversy over using that, but, you'll never be able to export that geothermal energy to Oahu, where Honolulu is, you know, 1 million+ people. You know, I have solar on my roof, you know, wave energy. I'm not incredibly bullish on wave energy. And, you know, so you're ticking on nuclear, right? There's no way you could find a siting for nuclear here in the state of Hawaii. Just never going to happen from a political palatability standpoint. I'm, in general, pro-nuclear, but just the state of Hawaii, it's not going to work. And so you're ticking off all these, you know, potential energy sources to transition away from, you know, we pay the highest price for energy in the entire country. We're paying 44 cents per kilowatt hour right now. So how do we reduce that and transition away from, you know, carbons or hydrocarbons? And the only answer that, you know, has the potential to do that is ocean thermal energy conversion, yet there is very little interest in doing that. So I started digging in deeper and deeper, and, you know, I got a lot of pushback from colleagues. Again, Bitcoin bad for the environment. You know, the Mora et al. Paper made the rounds, and everybody knew about that in the New York Times. And so, of course, Bitcoin was bad for the environment, and, you know, Bitcoin was going to push us over the 1.5 degrees Celsius, you know, limit alone. And so that was tough, but I kept with it. And eventually, you know, I kept working on this and digging into, you know, this technology, ocean thermal energy conversion. And then I started eventually reaching out to, you know, companies that had built the last ocean thermal energy conversion plant on the Big Island of Hawaii. I started reaching out to researchers who had been, you know, writing papers on it for decades. And it turns out that the reason ocean thermal energy conversion has not been commercialized successfully, even though it's been around for 100+ years, it's not a technical reason, but an economic reason. And, you know, with my experience in Bitcoin, I put two and two together, and then I found my co-founder, Michael Bennett, Michael Hawaii on Twitter, and we were, you know, working on this Bitcoin, local Bitcoin community here. You know, we have our local Bit Devs, Honolulu Bit Devs. Shout out to Raw BTC, who's doing a bang up job with that. So, and we're now sponsored by the state, so we have a grant from the state for our Bitcoin community, and we're hitting all time high numbers, which is lovely. So if you happen to be in the island on the last Monday of the month, please come check us out. We'd love to see you. And you know, so I it had been this small little get together of about four people at Michael's house, and Warren Tagami from Blockstream came one day to start to, you know, codify it into a real meetup group, you know, Honolulu Bit Devs, just like Austin or San Francisco Bit Devs. And I show up to the first official meeting and started derailing the conversation to talk about magical water technology powered by Bitcoin. And you know, everyone was like, oh, shut up, Nate. And then eventually, you know, I gave this talk for the state of Hawaii. And that was when people started to listen. And Michael took the time to really dig in deep and do his due diligence. And at the end concluded, oh, you have something. So Michael and myself co-founded OceanBit out of my garage here in Kailua, Hawaii. Sorry, long background, company history.
No, that's what we love, man. That's perfect. Absolutely perfect. One question. How did you manage that to get an American state to fund a Bitcoin meetup? Or did I get that wrong?
So I've been doing, I've been on the, I don't know if you've heard much about how much Hawaii hates Bitcoin in general. You know, we banned Bitcoin exchanges back in 2015, and the state set up a digital currency innovation lab through the Department of Financial Institutions to, you know, study the issue, and they set up a sandbox program where certain exchanges were exempt from the, you know, the 2015 rule. It was an application process, and they needed an advisory board. And so I had another company at the time, and they invited me to sit on this advisory board. And I was the sole Bitcoin maximalist sitting on the board. There were, you know, a bunch of NFT guys and crypto junkies, and they were all saying, oh, crypto, blah, blah. And I was pushing the, you know, no, there is only Bitcoin. And I was proven right. So when, you know, we were looking for, we had, you know, the startup started at Michael's parents' house. We moved to Michael's, you know, apartment complex, and eventually they got angry at us for having too many people, so we needed a new space. So, you know, the DFI and you know, some of the guys we were working with on the DCIL project, involved with the Hawaii Technology Development Corporation. And we needed a place to stay, and they have a the Entrepreneur's Sandbox, and they offered us, you know, a $3,000 grant to, you know, build our community there. We have, you know, room for up to 50, and yeah, it was just the work that I did, you know, yelling at the shit coins and calling out scams. Being fantastic, right.
Yeah, fantastic. That's brilliant. $3,000 is quite a bit, you know, just to get like that, to build a community. A lot can be done with that. Yeah. Especially if you sort of leverage social media presence and all of that. We're already half an hour in and haven't spoken about it yet. Let's get to it. OceanBit Energy leverages ocean thermal. Spell it out for me again, OTEC. What does it stand
for? Ocean Thermal Energy Conversion.
All right. And if you go to the website that you guys have, there's a lot of different technologies, a lot of different solutions that you guys sort of offer. And from what I understood, OTEC is basically the foundation for all of them. So tell me, what makes OTEC special? How does it work? Why? You already alluded to why it's not being implemented, purely economic reasons. Is there anything else? Let's get into that a bit.
Well, it's had a string of, so ocean thermal energy conversion utilizes the difference in temperature between warm surface water in the tropics and the deep cold water, right? It's, the planet brings that deep cold water from the poles back to the equator underwater. It's called the thermohaline circulation. And, you know, when you have a, temperature differential, you can always extract energy, right? And of course, the efficiency of that energy generation depends on, you know, that temperature difference. So with ocean thermal energy conversion, you're talking about, you know, 20 degrees delta T. So it's a very low thermal efficiency system, but, well, the fuel is free and the ocean is very large. So you can use, you know, with geothermal, it's very hot. You're talking about hundreds of degrees Celsius. With ocean thermal, you're talking about tens of degrees Celsius. So you need a lot of heat source and heat sink, but the ocean can provide that. And let's see, what was the other half of the question?
Yeah, just, you know, how does it work until? So this podcast is very technology focused. If you want to, can go into the technical details. You know, does it work like a fridge, basically, like a reverse fridge? Where
it's a Rankine cycle. Yeah, you use the warm water to, in an evaporator with a ammonia-based working fluid. You use the warm water to, evaporate the ammonia. Then you run that ammonia steam through a turbine, which expands it, right? You know, then you use a condenser with the cold water to condense that ammonia back to a liquid. Then you pump it back up to pressure and just run the cycle again. It's a very, very basic heat engine. It's, older than the internal combustion engine. And even Nikola Tesla had worked on this at one point. The technology was actually inspired by Jules Verne, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. And so it's a very old technology, but yeah, it's been hampered by economics and political risk. It's very low efficiency, and for a long time, hydrocarbons were cheap, plentiful, especially for island states. But at some point, there was the flippening. but there had been actually a number of projects that had been funded for ocean thermal energy conversion. the Carter administration had spent, allocated $800 million to build out a 40 megawatt OTEC facility for the state of Hawaii. And so one of the, first people I had reached out to, Dr. Luis Vega, and who is now an advisor for our company. He's a retired researcher, spent his entire career researching and, really digging deep into OTEC's potential and improving on it. He was on the team tasked with designing this 40 megawatt power plant that was fully funded. Well, when Carter was not reelected, he and Reagan came in. There's a famous, photo and video of Reagan taking the solar panels that Jimmy Carter had put on top of the White House. Well, the real story behind that is he also cut the, all the funding for all the renewable energy projects. So this, this project that was already underway, had already been scoped out, to build the most efficient system possible. They got quotes on everything. We're ready to push the order button and build it. Just got their legs cut out. So, yeah.
Yeah. And, all right.
Yeah.
Damn. What's the, you said it's very inefficient. What's the LCOE, levelized cost of energy, for those who hear it for the first time?
So it's an economy of scale. So the bigger you build, the cheaper it is. And, you can get down to 5 cents per kilowatt hour.
Okay.
Obviously it depends on how big you build.
Yeah, exactly. So what do these sites look like in the ocean? Is it like borehole size, when you have these boreholes that that get set up in the middle of the ocean, digging, pumping oil and stuff like that? Is it like that size, or do you have to imagine something way bigger than that?
Yeah, it's going to be about the size of a, FPSO, think like an oil rig, offshore oil rig drilling platform. But the difference between OTEC and oil is that you're not interacting with the seafloor, right? You're not drilling into the seafloor, because you're just using water from depth, right? 1,000 meters deep. And that's above, most of the ocean is around 4,000 meters deep. So you're pulling up water from sort of a mid depth to the surface. And you're looking at, a pretty big pipe. You need roughly a 10 meter pipe for diameter, 10 meter diameter pipe for 100 megawatt OTEC. But in reality, you use a bundle of smaller pipes. That right now the best way to do this. And then there's, of course, if you want to get bigger, right now the theoretical largest plant you could build is around a 400 megawatt OTEC plant. But there are ways to build bigger, by essentially creating a caisson in the ocean, and then you drill, you sit the caisson on the shallow continental shelf, and then drill a tunnel from the bottom of the caisson through the continental shelf down to the big drop off at around 1,000 meters depth. So there's ways to over, and then you don't need the big pipe because it's a permanent fixture, but the pipe is the, there's a crossover between whether it's more economical to build on land versus building a plant ship offshore versus building caisson style. And there's an economic crossover, but where our focus is on offshore plant ships,
Okay, amazing. I mean, just to colorize this a bit, and maybe this is not fitting, but you will tell me if it is or not. When you go swimming in a lake, right, you will feel that the water sort of at the top is very, very warm from the, from the sun. in standing water or lightly moving water. And then as you sort of go deeper, you have this drop off. Everybody that has been diving before knows this, right? So where
you drop off.
Exactly. And then you have this sharp drop off in temperature. And essentially that temperature difference is what you're using to create that power, right? And the bigger the depth or the deeper you go, the more the temperature difference increases, the more volume you pump up. I mean, 10 meters in diameter, that's a pipe, man. That's quite big. And a lot of volume, as you said, needs to come through. Yeah, it's a big ass pipe. So you need to have a lot of volume through there. Okay, gotcha. And so isn't it a problem to power communities on land with that? Sort of how far away from the coast does it have to be? Do you transmit medium voltage power then? Do you need to include transformers in this? Sort of how would you connect this to a community that consumes power on land?
You can use a high voltage power cable from offshore. You know, you can build them as far offshore as you want. You just have a longer power cable, right? And then there's a landing on land where, that's the connection to the local utility, and then they handle it from there.
All right. Okay. Let's talk about mining. You mentioned a couple of times now that this is a very, what's the right word? It's not very, very easy to sell to someone who's supposed to invest in this, seemingly because the investment cost is quite high. You're going into the middle of the ocean, you're building big ass pipes and putting them into the ocean and pumping shit and creating ammonia and all sorts of other stuff, right? So sounds quite expensive. Where does Bitcoin mining fit in here? Why did it make click back then when you first discovered this?
Yeah, like I said, it's an economic problem. The largest offshore plant ship that's been built to date was OTEC 1. It was a 1 megawatt plant size. Dr. Luis Vega was involved in that as well. And OTEC really finds its economic foothold at about, the 50 plus megawatts, right, for connecting to land. 50 megawatt, 100 megawatt is really the sweet spot where you get down to a nice low LCOE for island states. The problem is you can't go straight, two orders of magnitude, right? You have to build, a pilot plant. And this is the 10 megawatt problem. It's also, it's referred to as the Innovation Valley of Death, right? There's lots of money for small-scale research and development, up to 1 megawatt from, government grants. So those have been done exhaustively in multiple countries. And then, of course, at the, the large scale, it becomes a no-brainer. The LCOE gets down low enough, and it becomes attractive to, commercial investment. The problem is you have to build somewhere in the 10 megawatt range. And the problem is if you have to connect that to land, it becomes the LCOE doesn't reach that economies of scale. So you connect it to land, the power you're providing is too expensive for the grid. No one's going to buy. I pay 44 cents per kilowatt hour. Nobody's going to pay 50 plus cents per kilowatt hour for 10 megawatt energy plant, right? And so no one, from the private equity or, it's too big for the government's britches and not profitable enough for, the utility or private investment. Mm-hmm. And that was because the only buyer would have been at that time, the only buyer of this energy would be a, municipality, utility. And it's not very efficient. You have to have, again, a long power cable, right? Has cost. You have to have a mooring. That power plant has to be in place. Right. So now you have to deal with, if you're in the US and Hawaii, that's all the three-letter organizations you can think of. Getting a deep water mooring, permanent deep water mooring in the state of Hawaii takes 10 years. So you add that to the LCOE. You know, you have to get, you have to make it hurricane proof so it can withstand a hurricane. You're out at sea. Again, that's another huge expense. So now you have to purpose build a platform for it. And here in Hawaii are, you know, we're sort of towards the edge of the OTEC zone. We're at the, you know, OTEC works best in the tropics, and the closer to the equator you are, the more efficient it is, right? Higher delta T. Each degree Celsius gets you around 15% more energy for the same piece of equipment. So what Bitcoin does is it allows us to move that 10 megawatt OTEC plant from, let's say, offshore Hawaii, where we would be paying, you know, the cost of electricity would be around 54 cents per kilowatt hour. And we could take that same piece of equipment, and now, because Bitcoin can monetize stranded energy, and this power plant is a ship, it's mobile. We can move it. So what we can do is we can go track the highest delta T in the world, which is in the Western Pacific, you know, kind of over by Guam, Papua New Guinea, the Philippines. And so we can push that delta T 5-6 degrees higher than we would get here in Hawaii. So that equates to, you know, a 1.7x multiplier. So with a 10 megawatt plant built for Hawaii, we would be generating 17 megawatts. Well, more energy, lower LCOE, and now we've cut that long power cable because we can co-locate those Bitcoin miners on site. So now we don't need that power cable. And since we're in the middle of the ocean, we no longer need a mooring. And again, you know, no mooring, you're not interacting with the seafloor. There's very little regulatory oversight on that. Pretty much just fishing, right? You're not you know, destroying the ocean. You're just moving water through a system and returning it. You know, you're not dumping, you know, ammonia. The ammonia is in a you know, closed cycle, so you're not dumping that into the ocean. So there's no, you know, MARPOL doesn't really need to be involved. The only regulatory body at that point is SOLAS, which is the Safety of Life at Sea, which, of course, I'm going to be on this ship, so SOLAS is very important to me. And so you can, you know, cut your CapEx by over 50%. You can increase your energy by 1.7x. And for the first time in history, in the middle of the ocean, you can monetize OTEC from R&D to the pilot plant, and then even further. And this is really a game changer. It's something that OTEC has never had. You know, the beauty, another beautiful thing is at the equator, there are no hurricanes. You know, hurricanes work on the Coriolis effect, and they do not cross the equator. So it's very calm waters. It's called the doldrums for a reason. So the, you know, the survivability conditions are drastically reduced, which of course means that you can take any ship and just outfit it with an OTEC plant and float it out to the equator. And this is just an absolute game changer. We can, you know, we can take, you know, ships that are in ship graveyards, like the entire old Panamax class vessels. After the Panama Canal in 2015 was expanded, an entire class of vessels was, you know, made uneconomical. And now all those Panamax vessels that were built, you know, you build ships designed for how big it is to fit the largest size that can fit through a certain canal. So Panamax means it's the largest vessel that can fit through the Panama Canal, and Suez Max is the largest vessel that can make it through the, you know, the Suez Canal. And when the Panama Canal was expanded, well, there's the new Panamax class vessel. And so the old Panamax becomes uneconomical. Well, turns out the uneconomical Panamax class vessel is overkill for what we need, and they're dirt cheap. Their prices have collapsed.
So you're even then using resources that are still there. And it makes a ton of sense on paper. But then the end goal is not to mine Bitcoin, right?
Yeah. Bitcoin is a means to an end. There's plenty of energy technologies that are out there, but had no way to, monetize them in the early days, right? There's no buyer. There's no, it's the same reason why we don't have OTEC today. No, the grid can't, stomach that LCOE. But you can cut all that cost and you can monetize from, even the small, you're not going to be profitable, but you can still monetize the energy at each stage, going R&D, proof of concept, and then pilot plant. I can monetize each stage, which is it's a revolutionary energy technology to be able to do that. I mean, fusion energy, they're not able, when fission was being developed, no way to monetize it. So it was just eating that cost. Fusion energy, the same. We've still got another 30, 40 years before fusion even has a chance. But they can, every time they turn that on, if they hook up some miners, they can soak up that energy rather than just wasting it. And that's a much more palatable case. So, we can monetize that energy through our, each step. And then, once we get to that economies of scale, now you're able to prove it, demonstrate revenue. It becomes an easy, it becomes a much easier, to get a loan, because now you have, from the World Bank or for, developing economy, because you've now proven it. And at large scale, so, places like the Marshall Islands maybe need 20 megawatts worth of energy, right? They're, small energy users. And so, but when you're building, OTEC, you want to build large. So there's this disconnect. What do you do? So the idea is, Bitcoin becomes the major focus through the pilot plant, and then it becomes a sort of solution for a curtailment problem. How do you get 100 megawatt LCOE to a nation that needs 20 megawatts of, energy? Well, if you were to, build a 20 megawatt OTEC plant, they can't afford it. Marshall Islands doesn't have money. So what you do is you build a 100 megawatt OTEC plant, and then they take what they need and you use Bitcoin to backfill the rest, while that country, well, now that you've dropped the cost of energy for the Marshall Islands by a factor of four, all these new businesses become viable there. And so then they, over time, they grow their energy use, and you just slowly taper off the Bitcoin until they fill that whole 100 megawatt.
So this is why I love doing this podcast so much, and also one of the reasons why I started it, because through it you even learn new sort of angles, right? I had never thought about, hey, what about we upsize the power need 5x, mine Bitcoin with the 80 megawatts, right? And wait until sort of slowly that demand picks up, right? Because that's sort of what I've been thinking about coming from mini-grids. Much, much smaller scale, but exactly the same idea, right? The problem with mini-grids is, in Africa especially, you deliver a 40 kilowatt power plant, solar, right? People are skeptical. They don't know, are you going to just take their money and run like the three other companies that came before you? Right, it's going to take time until people buy appliances, buy fridges, buy TVs, buy fans, buy phones, whatever, and it takes time. But you've already invested that money, that 200,000 US you already invested, right? And you got nowhere for the power to go. And it's exactly the same principle. In comes Bitcoin mining, raising the price floor from zero to what, X, and it completely flips the the economic calculation on its head. So I love that, right? But obviously, sort of to maybe sum up what you said during the last 10, 20 minutes, you're using the idea to put OTEC on a ship, make it move, have less regulation, have more efficiency, and just an overall better economic situation for a pilot project to make the OTEC idea palatable and then transfer it onto more solutions. Did I sum that up correctly?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct.
Okay. Talk to me about nodules, Nate. Remember those. Give me a bit of background on the nodules and maybe also that how that ties in with the shipping and the energy use at sea.
So, you know, one such application for OTEC is powering grids around the world, you know, in the tropics. Another use case is powering the blue economy. 70% of the planet is water, and there is lots of economic activity that could be going on there outside of course, fishing. The problem is they don't have a viable, the only power source at the moment is marine diesel, which is, you know, bunker fuel. It is the nastiest, dirtiest shit. 7 large container ships produce more, you know, CO2, they produce such a shitty fuel. They're producing, you know, NOx, SOx, all the really nasty, disgusting fuels. There's all this economic activity that could be going on in the ocean that is hampered. Trillions of dollars is inaccessible because of the high cost of energy in the middle of the ocean. One of these use cases, and my particular favorite, is deep sea mining. So I don't know if have you seen all the cobalt,
stuff? Yeah, dude. Yeah. That show on Rogan, I listened. I don't listen to many of his shows, but that one I listened, and it was mind blowing. Absolutely, yeah. I definitely recommend anybody who's here. Look at Joe Rogan. Type into Google or whatever. Rogan and copper or what was it called? No, cobalt. It wasn't copper. Cobalt mining.
Cobalt.
In Congo, I think, right? 75% comes from there. Mined under horrible conditions. And that's also what I tell people all the time. Like, we celebrate, Germans often celebrate, you know, the Energiewende, the push to renewables around the world. But, and then we talk about all the CO2 that we save, right? But then nobody talks about those costs. Yeah. But I'm starting listen to it.
Yes,
and
please.
Come back. Anyway, you keep going.
The cobalt we use in every single device, electronic device, it's a crucial, metal. Every device, every PV panel, every battery, everything the modern world needs to continue has cobalt in it. And that cobalt is virtually all produced through child slave labor. It's disgusting. They call it artisanal mining. And it's absolutely abhorrent. It is one of the worst forms of slavery the world has ever experienced. And if we're going to make that transition, you know, the economic calculus right now is everyone saying, shrugging their shoulders. You can't live without your phone. And that's a tacit approval of these practices. Well, it turns out that there is an alternative source for that cobalt, as well as manganese, copper, and nickel, which are all, again, mined in unethical ways. And, you know, of course, digging into the ground anywhere is not good for the health of the workers or the health of the planet. This alternative source has many, many multiples, orders of magnitude greater abundance of those minerals than are available terrestrially. They just, and they're, you don't have to remove, you know, mountaintops. There's no mountaintop removal. You don't have to clear cut the forest to get at them. They are literally sitting, you know, on the surface. They are these little balls of metal called polymetallic nodules or manganese nodules. The problem is that they, while that, yes, they are sitting on the surface and you can just pick them up, they are also 4,000 meters below the surface of the ocean. And they are in the middle of the ocean. And, well, it has been so far uneconomical to get them because of the high cost of energy in the middle of the ocean. And, you know, industrial scale mining operation would use an incredible amount of marine diesel, which, you know, then you have to make that sort of carbon accounting calculus and say, well, if we have to burn all this bunker fuel to go get these things, is it really going to be green? No. And this is where OTEC comes in. All of the four major manganese nodule regions in the world happen to be in the tropics. And the largest one is the Clarion-Clipperton Fracture Zone that's located around 1,000 kilometers southeast of the state of Hawaii. And so the idea is that OTEC, powered by Bitcoin, can reach the scale to where it drops the cost of energy in the middle of the ocean so low that the economic calculus becomes inevitable, that pulling up these little balls of metal, you know, as big as a, you know, a melon, or as small as a few centimeters, but there are trillions of these little balls, and I think the we ran the numbers. It's something like $60 trillion worth of these metals are just sitting there on the bottom of the ocean, waiting for somebody to come get them. And you know, the UN has already you know, parceled up and sold off the rights to certain, you know, highly valuable plots, and has set aside certain areas for conservation, and then has given away the rights to, you know, about a quarter of the total area in the CCZ to developing economies. And OTEC can flip, make that calculus a lot easier.
Right. Okay, so you're saying basically that through Bitcoin mining, making OTEC more palatable, getting more research money behind it, proving the pilot, delivering maybe electricity to land, to communities, to consumers there, you can also do that to basically harvest the most interesting and sought after commodities that we currently have in the world, right? And again, yeah, all linked back to Bitcoin, because that's the only technology that can monetize energy anywhere, even
again, in the middle of the ocean. It's the same situation as the Marshall Islands as well, where, you know, the right now the metals company had a quarter-sized demonstrator, you know, uneconomical to run, but they, you know, did their pilot plant, right? And it used about 10 megawatts worth of energy. So our pilot plant can help there for, you know, a feed study. But a full-size manganese nodule operation would use about 40 megawatts, needs about 40 megawatts. Well, I can build a 100-megawatt OTEC plant, get them a cheaper cost for energy, and mine Bitcoin on the side. It's the same, you know.
And fill the gap when there's no mining going on, right? Let's say
exactly. They have variable energy use.
There's Christmas every year, apparently, right? So there's going to be holidays. People are going to go home. Like, there's not going to be anything going on. So then, you know, you have 100 megawatts worth of power. And what do you do with that? It's just stranded. It's just sitting there. Again, just makes it more economical.
Maybe this more. This is not the only giant industry. You know, it's not just manganese nodules. You know, we have SBIR, Small Business Innovation Research Grants, producing ammonia, you know, for use as a fertilizer or fuel source, as well as, desalinating water. One of the, in one way that you can do OTEC, you produce fresh water as a byproduct. That's another use case where we can produce fertilizer and fresh water for export. You can locate it offshore, moored, or, at the equator. Hydrogen production, if the shipping industry is to decarbonize as a whole, and it looks like they're sort of gravitating to hydrogen, well, a truck stop in the middle of the ocean. Instead of building the hydrogen infrastructure at every single port in the world, which would be just a crazy economic spend, you could reduce that infrastructure by an order of magnitude by having what are essentially truck stops in the middle of the ocean. So, when people say, I've seen a lot of, going through the raise right now, our initial raise, you see a lot of, articles saying, oh, don't pitch gas stations, nobody wants to buy a restaurant. Well, I want to build restaurants at gas stations in the middle of the ocean. The space industry, right now, commercial space industry is on the cusp, and land-based spaceports have an issue where, you can't launch rockets over people's heads because they blow up, right? Why didn't we shoot down that balloon over, South Carolina? Why did we wait till it went to the ocean? Because we don't want shit falling on people's houses. So when you take, you look at SpaceX and their, spaceport at Boca Chica, well, they have about 3 degrees of launch. So, you can't launch them over, Texas, over Houston. No, you can't do that. You have to launch them over the ocean. And so, SpaceX has been hiring, we've all seen them land their Falcon 9s on barges offshore. But in order to get the cost of energy, of, the launch costs down by an order of magnitude, you have to move to the equator. You have to move to places where there are no people, that you can launch rockets in any direction, 360 degrees, and the only place that fits the bill is the middle of the ocean. You need a power source out there. You need to be able to generate your own fuel on site. And turns out that a lot of what you could do with an OTEC plant in the middle of the ocean serving as a spaceport, it has a deep water port, but you have a lot of the same resources that you would have on Mars. So any sort of Mars operation would need to first be built in the middle of the ocean. And then eventually it's the space elevator. Rockets are not going to be the end all be all. We're not going to be taking rockets to space anytime soon. But a space elevator could make that possible, but it takes a huge amount of power on both sides. You have a geosynchronous orbit satellite over an OTEC plant connected with a carbon nanotube or graphene, based ribbon. And you just take an elevator up to space. You reduce the cost by an order of magnitude or two, and that has to be located in the middle of the ocean.
Get into the elevator, press the button for Mars, and there you go.
Yeah, you would take it up to, you'd use a slingshot to take the Mars, but you take the elevator to get to orbit.
No, Nathan, I want to be getting in there pressing a button. Like, I, you know, when I'm in the mall, I want to go to the first floor, I press a button. Like, I want to, you know, no mask, no nothing, no suit. Anyway, sometimes people talk about, you know, and I don't want to get you started on the Kardashev scale, but people talk about how Bitcoin energy use sort of has the chance to catapult humanity into sort of the next state, the next phase, basically. And what you're describing alludes to that a lot, right? Where you have these ports in the middle of the ocean where people can wine and dine, all powered by old tech, initially bootstrapped by Bitcoin, right? Maybe to get back down to earth a little bit, the current bear market and the drop in hash price, does that hinder your storytelling? Does that hinder the economics, the modeling at all? Do we have to wait until Bitcoin price goes to where most of us think it will? Give me a little bit of feedback on that.
No. You know, it goes in cycles. These cycles are, you know, bull market, bear market, and, you know, when you're building large-scale infrastructure, you don't care about the day-to-day price. You know, if you're if you've leveraged, you know, if you're a large mining company and you've, you know, received loans on the value of your ASICs, yeah, the day-to-day ASIC, you know, Bitcoin price makes a big difference. But when you're building large-scale infrastructure and thinking over 30-year terms, amortizing over 30 years, the day-to-day price really doesn't matter. And so, you know, and there's not a lot of great models for, you know, predicting things outside of, you know, 4 or 5 year time span. For us, we had to develop our own model that basically looks at the 4 year running average. You know, most models are 4 year terms total, and ours is roughly a 4 year average price. And I guess the idea that comes out of it is that and what the models, you know, my model says is that Bitcoin will act as a sort of international energy arbitrage opportunity, and that over time, as Bitcoin grows, it will sort of, you know, arbitrage the cost of energy at different locations until the world reaches a global, you know, sort of energy base floor, you know, base price at around, you know, today's dollars, around 6 cents per kilowatt hour by sometime in 2050s, 2060s.
All right. And just to explain that quickly, you're saying everywhere where power is cheap, Bitcoin miners will come in, increasing the price. Prices come down, Bitcoin miners move there, and levels, it sort of levels out. The Bitcoin mining levelizing, fills the nooks, the nooks and crannies of that platform where you have, I think, who spoke about this? The name eludes me now. But if you sort of imagine a flat surface where you have hills for higher energy prices and nooks and crannies and gaps for lower energy prices, you know, Bitcoin mining is like water. It goes where the nooks and crannies are first and then sort of levels everything out.
Exactly. All
right, interesting. Cool. Maybe one quick question towards the end, Nate. I listened to the What Bitcoin Did episode that you guys did. What happened since then? Do you want to give a quick sort of roundup of where you guys stand today and how people can help, what you guys are looking for, where you're going next?
Sure. Since then, we have brought on a number of advisors. We've sort of rounded out the team. We brought on a naval architect with 30 years of experience. He wrote the paper on ship conduct, you know, the paper that was sort of the inspiration for the container ship refabrication, reclassification. He wrote the paper on how to do ship conversion for OTEC. naval architect guy in the North Sea, working on platform, FPSOs in the North Sea. And if you can build in the North Sea, well, the equator is essentially retirement, right? It's vacation. It's easy. So he's on board. We've brought on Dr. Luis Vega, who is the preeminent researcher in OTEC for, 50 years. We've brought on the CTO of a major public mining Bitcoin mining company, and we've brought on the CEO of a major Bitcoin exchange. These are sort of rounding out the team. So that's the team build. We've been refining our, models. We've been refining our messaging. I'm not as good as Michael is. I'm too plugged into the science of it. And we've started sort of clearing some of the space at Nelha. So our phase one, which we're currently in the process of raising capital for, is the first grid-connected OTEC plant in the world was built at Nelha, the Natural Energy Laboratory Hawaii Authority here in Hawaii on the Big Island. The tower, if you go to our website or Makai's website, it was done as a collaboration between Lockheed and Makai, and we're not working with Lockheed, so we're taking down Lockheed's heat exchangers and going to replace them with ours. So we've started construction. We've received some SBIR funds. I think I mentioned that before. So we have some revenue. We're doing research, rounded out the team, refined all of basically everything we've done. It's a bear market, so we have to go more in depth. We plan to really, really hit the road here very shortly and complete the raise by, the end of the quarter.
Sounds amazing, man.
And if you want to help, if you want to help, we have you feel free to reach out on our website and we will get back to you.
You know what the story you said about the North Sea just now reminded me of a quick anecdote that I'd like to leave here is when I did my diving certification, I learned how to dive in England, right, in an English pond, and I was too cheap to do the recommended dry suit qualification as well. And so I sat in that pond doing my exercises underwater 10 meters deep, talking about temperatures of water in deeper levels again. And when I came out, I couldn't open my mouth anymore because my whole jaw was so tense from gripping onto the mouthpiece when going diving. If you can do OTEC in the North Sea, then it's like learning how to dive in an English pond. If you can do it there, you can do it anywhere. And with that, Nate, I would like to thank you very much for your time. I know we went a bit over, but I think it's all good. I would definitely love to have you back. You're a wealth of knowledge. It's been so fun listening to you. I see there's sort of little tangents going on. Your brain is firing. You're going to this direction, and it's just a ton of knowledge there. So I deeply appreciate your time. Do you want to add anything else? Anything that we haven't spoke about?
No, I think that pretty well covers it. Just thanks for having me, Jesse. It was an absolute pleasure. You're doing a great job. And I'd love to come back on.
Cool. All right. With that, aloha. There you go. Is it mahalo for goodbye and aloha for today, for good day, or is it aloha for both?
Aloha for both. Mahalo is thank you.
All right. Cool. Mahalo, Nate. Thank you very much. Guys, check out Breeze. Check out Fountain for Value Bitcoin podcasting. Leave likes, ratings, subscriptions, all the good stuff. Connect with us on Telegram, Twitter, email. If you have questions, let me know. I try to answer my emails as best as possible. This is a hobby of mine, so it's not my main job, so bear with me there. If you have any questions for guests or whatever, I'm pretty sure we can, or just in general, we can also integrate them into the show, into the next episode. I hope you were able to take something away. Oh, shit, Nate, I forgot something. Quickly, your take, right? Bitcoin does not use enough electricity to round out the episode as per usual. What's your take on that?
Yes, it does not use enough energy. I want to turn on, you know, terawatts.
There you go. All right, guys, until next time. See you. Hello, hello. If you're listening to this, it means you're right at the end of the episode, so thank you for listening. Recently, Relay got in touch with me and asked if I wanted a code. I said, yep, I use them anyway to DCA into Bitcoin. They offer a KYC light, easy way to do that. So just by paying as low as 1% fees, you can stack sats automatically into your own hardware wallet, and that's well worth the peace of mind, I think. Relay is available in most European nations, and they offer an OTC desk for more volume as well, where the ref code is applicable. If you want to support the show and you DCA anyway, or you want to start doing it, I'm happy if you use my code. It'll help me out a little bit without you having to do anything. The ref code is simple. It's just my name, Jesse, J-E-S-S-E. So yeah, find the link in the show description and see you next time. Peace.